The Protect Your Neck Podcast, UFC Denver After Party Edition. No dance, no chance. Savages, this is the Protect Your Neck Podcast, a podcast dedicated to high-level MMA, and I am your host, Dan Tom, analyst and writer for FlowCombat.com, and tonight we are going to be breaking down the post-fight technique storylines and whatever else you want if you've used the hashtag Protect Your Neck Podcast to participate in our submissions and transition segment, which will come later in the show, but yeah, if you're not familiar with the Protect Your Neck Podcast, we either do top five shows, you know, usually in off between weeks or before fight cards. Of course, we do breakdown shows where I get in-depth with my gaming and technical analysis for the upcoming UFC cards. And of course, occasionally, we do the After Party Edition. Now, this one, I am by myself because I'm watching it here at home with my dogs, aka my children and my lady. So I'm doing this one solo, but that's okay because, to be honest, this podcast was initially created to be a solo format, kind of like Bill Burr's Monday Morning Podcast, if anybody's a fan of that. So you know, I've got the dog and the lady here, so I'm halfway there, right? Anyways, but this one's more about MMA, so you're gonna get my commentary here, yours if you participate, and yeah, I'll be kind of held accountable. My picks here, we're going to kind of go through from bottom to top. Before I get there, let's get into UFC Denver. First of all, if anyone's a hardcore fan of Denver, you know, maybe back from the, you know, UFC Fight Night 13, Lozon, Florian days, you'll notice that we had the same refs from then. And the Denver Commission's a unique one because, how do I say, they just have really funny-looking people officiating their fight cards. I mean, my favorite, first of all, Tim Mills, apparently is a nice guy who someone reached out for me on Twitter and said he's an Eskrima stick expert, and I respect the Filipino stick fighting, but Tim Mills looks like Jim Norton. And I love Jim Norton, but it is really great. He looks much more composed. He looked really wide-eyed back in the, you know, Kenny Florian, Joe Lozon days. But yeah, you saw him make an appearance tonight. We also had, I don't remember his first name, but he looks like Pedro from Napoleon Dynamite. His last name is Martinez in real life, but yeah, looks like Pedro from Napoleon Dynamite. He made multiple appearances, and there was this really creepy ref with a beard who looked like freaking Michael Parks, who is the actor from a lot of Quentin Tarantino's movies from Dusk Till Dawn. Obviously, I'm going to say first, because if you know the music that I've been using, maybe not for tonight, but the music I usually use from that soundtrack. Michael Parks is a good actor, though. He was in Tusk, Red State, Kevin Smith's Red State. Yeah, and that ref looked like him, you know, just kind of petting his beard and just grimacing, you know, just smirking and smiling. And he ref the Jason Knight and Alex Caceres fight, and he also ref the Pantoja and Shelton fight. So, I mean, there was plenty to smile about, but it was just kind of a creepy smile, you know? It was like that bearded guy in the pawn shop from Pulp Fiction. You know, Zed's kind of running his train. Anyways, let's get out from there. Anyway, there's really celebrity doppelgangers for UFC Denver as the referees. We'll leave it at that. But hopefully, I don't know if anybody else saw those. Maybe took my sick, demented mind to make you see those. But go ahead and reach out to me and tell me how wrong or right I am on that. But we had four performances of the night bonuses. I kind of missed the beginning of the press here, but it seemed like it was one of those nights where there wasn't a clear cut fight of the night, so they took it in their hand to do performance of the night, which I respect, because just in spirit, it's like, it reminds me of the nights like Danny used to do. We're going to do 70K tonight. No, we're going to do 100K tonight. 100K is doing too much. We're doing 70K again tonight. And it kind of reminded me of that Fertitta Zuffa era, which I feel we're going to fondly look back on, and where, you know, they kind of took things into their own hands, and, excuse me. Hiccups. It's, again, I never get hiccups until I record. I think it's one of those things. It's like when I was a kid and I would go into a Blockbuster video. Remember those? If you don't, it means you're really young and I'm feeling really old. But I would always have to, you know, take a piss. Pardon my parlance there. But every time I'd have to go look at movies, and I think it's because I was so excited that it was like a dog. I have to go. And maybe there's something about podcasting that, you know, oh, I have to hiccup and fucking stutter and stammer all over my words, which I usually don't do. So I'm getting the hang of it. So I appreciate you hanging in there. So with no further ado, we're going to jump in on the very bottom. Started on Fight Pass. We had JC Cottrell versus Gonzalez. This is my first and, spoiler alert, only miss of the night. I had JC Cottrell and I wasn't super confident. This was on my fights to avoid list, which again, kind of wasn't posted. We're kind of toying with the format there with Flo and myself personally. So I'm going to really work hard to get a medium for you there for written, because even though I went to school and really love writing and all that stuff, it's not really my main thing. I really like doing this. I really like, you know, doing more hands-on things, but I still love the writing realm. So I'm going to make sure to get something presented to you with that. But this was definitely on my avoids list if you've been listening to the podcast. Essentially two debutantes making their second fight. Gonzalez, who looked impressive, but against much lower level competition. And then, you know, Cottrell, who looked impressive and a more experienced, but again, kind of an inflated record there. So kind of was deceptive on both their sample sizes. In other words, reason why I went with Cottrell, I felt like he was a little more well-rounded, although Gonzalez clearly more physical presence. So, I mean, not just that, but was, yes, he was more of a finishing threat. But I just felt Cottrell, he's one of those guys that kind of shows up on game night, and according to his training partners, they say the same. And I was expecting to see that. I was expecting to see building blocks, these little glimpses he showed, not just in his debut, because it's kind of unfair. Pacheres is a tough guy to debut against, but even in his fights prior to the UFC. Unfortunately, he did not, but Gonzalez looked good. And I really like that segment where Stan really breaks it down in depth. I hope he does more of those. You know, big shout out to Brian Stan there. He's awesome. But yeah, it was one. I tweeted, you know, Cottrell put down the pack. That's kind of a term I got from Robert Follis. Shout out to Robert Follis, amazing coach, former Team Quest, and now we're lucky enough to have him at Extreme Couture. But he uses this term, put down the pack, and it's kind of like, you know, if you're holding your breath and you exhale, that's putting down the pack. Now, if you talk about that in physical terms, especially in grappling, you can really, you know, especially people grapple, you really feel that when someone puts down the pack. As good as they are, athletic or explosive they are, if you can kind of ride out that storm, you know, that transition where they explode, they bridge to try to resist, and maybe they get a little success, and you kind of feel whether they have success or whether they don't, people kind of literally exhale and put down the pack, where this kind of term comes in. And if you feel that and you pick up the pack where they put down the pack, that's kind of a principle that I kind of look for within my own style of grappling, where I really try to feel when someone put down the pack, and that's when I press the gas. That's when you're going to have the most success. Now, this instance, it was a little different. It wasn't your typical Bravo choke setup, you know, off an underhook getup or places you would normally find it. I mean, Gonzalez is a very long frame for 155, so he did more of the Tony Ferguson where, you know, or even an early Paulo Thiago where he was going to, you know, kind of force his arm under there and kind of force that choke setup, and he did well from there. I like the three-finger grip, but he, you know, went palm to palm, clasped just fine, used his leverage greatly, finished it, you know, just fine. But it was a real fact that as soon as Cottrell went to turtle, you saw him exhale and quote-unquote put down the pack. And Gonzalez knew what to do. He picked it right up. Not only did he pick up the pack, he parlayed it into what looks like something that I would guarantee. I don't know him. I don't exactly know the people he trains with, but I guarantee that's something that he goes for a lot in practice with the way he applied it and was able to finish it without the typical leverage, although he cleverly did, you know, was able to hook the leg, like Brian Stan brilliantly pointed out. All right, we're going to move on to Pantoja versus Shelton. I, and amongst many who were in the know, were really excited about this, and justifiably so. Whether you watch Tough or were like me and just contrarian, lazy, we can use a lot of words, just kind of faded out of Tough, kind of burnt out, right? A little jaded from it. You knew these guys were no joke. I mean, Shelton maybe not as much. He wasn't ranked. Pantoja was already kind of well in that unspoken top 10, if you will. Unwritten top 10, I should say. And like I said in the first one, I don't, dive too deep into it, but essentially Shelton has way more upside than Pantoja, and is super impressive looking. But the reason why I ended up siding with Pantoja and was a close on people bout was how he reacted in the fire, and we seen him in the fire. We saw him got froze up by uppercuts from the gentleman who I once again can't remember the name, so I'll refuse to stutter and stammer for you on that, but who he took the title from RFA, and he had kind of those brief moments in the first round, and Shelton connected cleanly. Didn't quite freeze him up or look in danger of stopping the fight as Pantoja has in the past, because he just, keeps stalking forward, which will catch up to him, mind you. I guess we'll talk about that later, but or at a further date. Shelton did hit him cleanly, and did some nice things there, but Pantoja's pressure, as bad as that is, and as much as I say that will catch up with him, it does pay off in instances like this, and that's why I picked him. He's willing to throw himself in the fire, and we've seen him in fire in multiple instances, and that counts a lot in my book when I'm looking at these things, especially a debutante who's young in his UFC debut. That's why I picked against, Sage and Worley with Brian Barberina, because, it's those type of, Brian didn't have the finishing premises of Pantoja, but sometimes you just even need the grindability and to kind of put that doubt and survive that storm and that pressure to kind of show different sides. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't mean Shelton has some weak side to show. I think he's got great upside. But that's why I picked against him here, although on first glimpse, you'd be like, Shelton all day, maybe, if you didn't know any better, and you're just kind of looking at him for face value, for instance. But yeah, Pantoja comes through, but regardless, I really am excited to see things from both, so excited there. Went over to FS1, where we all love that pacing. I didn't quite get laundry done, but I was able to get dishes and other things done. I hope you were able to get some stuff done during the FS1 commercial break timing, but it was Rogério de Lima versus Jordan, I believe is his first name, Kimball. Kimball, I almost wanted to change my pick as especially after the weigh-ins, de Lima missed weight. But I went with de Lima essentially because even though Kimball was live, which I stated, because of his durability. I mean, he doesn't just look like Roy Nelson. He's durable like him. I really just felt De Lima was going to have too many ways to win this fight. But, I wasn't too confident about that. It was kind of back and forth as I thought, which is why, by the way, it was on my avoid list. But it seemed that essentially, I don't want to take credit away or give too much credit to one guy and take credit away from the other. But it really essentially seemed like a slip. Was the reason I got to see the replay. It didn't seem as egregious. Like the cage came alive and tried to eat Jake Ellenberger. It tried to eat Jake Ellenberger. It didn't do that to Kimball, but it did look like something just really kind of awkward and weird. So you don't want to praise and default another guy too much there. Regardless, we take the check mark there. We take the win there, I guess, for the pick, but. I didn't play anything and don't regret playing anything despite being right. So the next fight is DiCirico versus Spicely. I was pretty high on DiCirico even before his fight with Boyan. Just looking at his fights prior to his UFC debut, he showed kind of the mid-career GSP renaissance, as far as he had great change-ups and transitions, would go for the takedowns really well. Really impressed there by DiCirico. But I couldn't back him here. Spicely, I was amongst the many that counted him out against Thiago Santos and dearly paid the price because I parlayed that inside the distance on five dimes like a mother effer there, to quote the parlance of Dwayne Ludwig. But yeah, I did not discount Spicely this time because DiCirico, even though he did appear to try to use his wrestling in reverse to the pressuring Spicely at first, I felt would ultimately fall into the pits that was Spicely's strengths. And so he did. I wish I had a replay to kind of break it down a little better for you as far as how he set up his catch. But, those who grapple know anybody can catch triangles, and there's so many fancy ways and fancy setups to catch triangles. What it really comes down to is the adjustments. Guys who are good at triangle chokes are good at adjusting. Now, you can have as much fancy setups as you want, but unless he can adjust, you're not going to be able to truly make your money there. And although Spice Lee didn't do anything fancy to adjust, he kind of showed you the different premises of from the basic pulling down on the head to what I prefer, kind of hooking the leg, which is kind of bad in MMA because they can sit and punch if you're really not confident and you have a lock. Or you can instead hook the underhook under the armpit, like an underhook getup, to kind of cut your angle to get that advantageous angle on the triangle choke. But what Spice Lee did was, Nate was kind of fighting with his posture and trying to position him. Not Nate, Jesus. DiCarico was trying to fight with his posture and trying to, position himself as best he could. But you saw Spice Lee there. What he did was he elevated his hips and he flexed. I mean, a lot of times you don't see that flex. And sometimes you can see it with the hips and the general motion if you know what you're looking for. But a kind of a good rule of thumb, if a guy is triangling his legs and he's trying to get that extra flex and he knows how to get that extra inch, you're going to see his foot inflect, the instep kind of curl upward. And that will insinuate that he is curling to get that finish. So, again, a triangle choke, I mean, three sides to kind of close off the airways, more than three angles to kind of go through your checklist. But you could see Spice Lee go through that checklist until he found his finish. So, good job on Spice Lee. I doubt he will be that underrated. But at the same time, I'm not sure how far his ceiling is. God, I don't want to hit it on that note. Spice Lee's awesome. Let me just hit on that note, because good on you, Spice Lee. All right, next one is De Silva versus Johnson. And we have so many Johnsons. This is Jordan Johnson. He's not French like another guy coming up, but, whatever. I picked Johnson in this one, despite not being a lot of footage. Like I said, there was only two solid sample size I could grasp before this. Aside from that, it was a lot of hunting down and, doing detective work. We'll leave it at that. And but I picked Johnson because, I felt that stylistically on paper, even if you didn't know much on him, you could see that, a wrestler with some process is going to pose problems for a guy like De Silva, who puts himself in bad positions, both standing and on the feet. And that's what happened. He danced with the frying pan and jumped in and out of the fire, but eventually just succumbed to Johnson's process, which wasn't a lot to write home about, but was really impressive when you consider it's his debut. I tweeted, he essentially, again, I'm not trying to be overwhelming with a statement because it wasn't like a flashy performance, but it felt like he essentially did in his debut what Jared Roschott was trying to accomplish in every UFC fight in his career. And that's not a knock on Jared Roschott, but that's just a real accurate statement to what you saw. To if you were in the know of Jared Roschott's skills coming into his debut before Walt Harris back in the day at that tough finale, I believe I was there for that one. That's what you were kind of hoping to see develop from Jared Roschott after his days on the regional scene. Anyways, this isn't a breakdown on Jared Roschott. This was on Jordan Johnson, who looks like he's 50 or 40 in his pictures, but through his post-fight, seems like he's 8 years old, which is kind of endearing, so I'm not hating on the guy there. But yeah, I almost kind of want to hear more interviews and see him fight now, just because that was ridiculous. That was like me and my friends in the pre-internet era, if he like gave us access to like a Facebook live stream in 1997. Like, is this on? that's what it felt like. But props to you, Jordan. Good on you. Arizona, I believe you're from. Anyways, that doesn't matter. All right, the next one was our first and only parlay piece, as I was high on my Chinese heritage related man, Ji Ling Jiang, or Li Jing Liang, I should say, as he fought Mr. Nash, Bobby Nash. This was kind of a back and forth brawl. It was sloppy like I expected and I was calling for, and if you saw Nash's fights prior, but Nash showed up on game day. You really got to give it to him, and he hit Li Jinglang with some shots that would have probably dropped most guys, as I'm sure you heard on the commentary. I agree. But yeah, I guess, again, forgive me, I grew up in the early 90s, but not only did Li Jinglang have retard strength, but retard durability. He was really, really powerful. Wow, now I feel really bad about saying that. That was really bad. Okay, maybe I get away from the first time, Dan. Let's stop using that now. All right. we're done. But yeah, he's really, really stupid strong. And I'm only saying that because I actually have known guys and pro fighters who've trained with him at Extreme Couture. And in his defense, which I did say before, not like I'm writing the guy off here. Someone who's part Chinese myself, I'm definitely, there's some bias there. I'm not gonna deny it. But knowing guys who train with him at Extreme Couture, he is really strong. And to his defense, like I said before, he is really smart. So my poor attempts of humor aside, make no mistake, Li Jing Lang has got a lot of potential. It's weird. You wouldn't expect it from looking at him. But he picks up things really fast. And again, like I point out, the reason why I'm not just saying he's strong is such a subjective, shallow opinion, but I mean, you can, you know, forget any inside information, you can see it. I mean, look at his fight, I believe, with Anton Zafir. You see him almost have that, you know, kind of head and arm guillotine, which is harder to finish than the regular guillotine, and Zafir's already passed the side control, which is the rule of thumb that cancels out the choke, and you see Li Jing Lang able to sweep him and kind of throw him over without the quote-unquote on-paper, proper, fundamental, whatever you have, you leverage points. You just gives no fucks. So props to that man. Was hoping to see a post fight. Did not get to see it. Hopefully they give Nash another shot because, this may seem like, you know, just throwing him in there, but he proved his mettle and he definitely deserves another shot. So I hope I didn't sound too dismissive on him on the breakdown podcast prior, but I was really impressed with what he showed and then hopefully they give him another shot there. Hopefully see Li Jing Lang at Extreme Couture, and hopefully I see him impress further. All right, next one, Sun Cao versus Sterling. Again, somebody who I hope I didn't come out too disrespectful on the last one was Sterling, but I was just trying to make the point of the sky is blue. We can't jump to conclusions. There was so much hype on Sterling in his first couple fights that by the time he ended up fighting Brian Caraway, the line was inflated, and although my Caraway pick is admittedly biased because I know the guy, I was still outright because that line wasn't right, and I do believe that Caraway was an on-paper bad matchup, even if Sterling went on to win that match, because it wasn't like Caraway blew him out of the water. I'm not, you know, meaning that, but I do stand by my statement of that it was an on-paper bad matchup. That said, I like Sterling. I'm rooting for Sterling, and I was really, even though I picked a Sun Cao, who I believe the judges got it right, I was really hoping to see those improvements in Sterling. And you can make arguments that he took the first round, and people that I highly respect gave him the first round. I don't think that's crazy at all, but I had the first two for Sun Cao and the last round for Sterling. But more important than, you know, I think it's often overlooked that even if a fighter loses, if he loses the first two rounds and wins the third, granted, it's not enough to keep his job or get him a win on the sure dog column there, but that should be respected. It says a lot, first of all, about a fighter's kind of heart and competitive nature. But more importantly than any of that mumbo jumbo is that Sterling showed the improvements that I was looking for in that boxing range. You know, even though he's kind of showing hints of that Philly shell, which some people like and don't like for MMA, I was just happy the fact that he was showing some comfortability, that by the third round he was loose enough that we were starting to see kind of that those the loose glimpses of things that you could tell that Aljo was working in the sparring room, in the practice room, in those sessions, sharpening, you know, turning over in the heat like a sword, and landing some nice jabs and putting some nice things together. And he's literally one or two punches away, one or two fights away from really putting it together to where he's going to be able to flow and meld it with those leg kicks. Because right now he's been using his kicks to kind of gauge range, dissuade opponents, disrupt opponents, and set up his shots. Once he can attach it to punches and get the punches that get respect and then attach those kicks, it's going to be a whole nother world because it's going to connect all his dimensions. And not that he should become a striker, because I think Aljo should keep focusing on the grappling. He's one of my favorite grapplers to watch. After watching him finish at Takeya Mitsugaki, anytime an opponent's turtled or I feel like I'm losing a back mount in the practice room, I'm always trying to lock up that choke now. It's just something that I'm kind of looking for, that inverted kind of rear naked arm triangle from a 45-degree angle, you know, and yeah, I love the kid's innovation, so I want to see him do what he's good at, but I want to see him improve too, and he showed that. So even though he didn't get the win, He seemed crushed. I hope he's not too crushed. And I really hope Aljo comes back strong. And as for Sun Tzu, he's going to need to make a statement in his next fight. I think I saw, was it Chuck Mendenhall? Who I like. Really, really good stuff. Really good writing. I believe he tweeted something like, Sun Tzu's the only person who's like winning his way further from a title shot. And it's hard to argue Chuck's point there. All right, we're going to go to the last fight of the prelims. Sam Alvey versus Nate Marquardt. Of course, I had Alvey. There's a bit of bias here with the MMA latest ties, you know. And, of course, I was going to say I'm good friends. Well, yeah, I'll stick by that. I'm good friends. I love Jordan Killian. I'm good friends with Jordan Killian, who is like one of Smile and Sam's best friends, Pound for Pound Podcast. Shout out to the Pound for Pound Podcast. Subscribe to them. So, I mean, there's definitely, bias there. I'm sure, you know, Jordan was shitting bricks. Earning my explicit. Was shitting bricks watching that Sam fight. And, yeah, I mean, there's three rounds worth. But you could see somewhere in that second round where Sam started really slow. He started the first round slow, no surprise, right? Sam even says so himself, to a detriment. Which I'm glad they pointed on the broadcast. Hopefully Sam goes back and reads that, you know, at the higher level, especially as Sam gets more well-known, being predictable no matter how good you are, you know, you got to start kind of adapting. But that being said, as much as I want Sam to adapt and be more successful looking ahead, he did show those adaptations, I do dare argue. He did. Granted, it took him to that momentum swings that I kind of aforementioned hinted to in the beginning of the second round. It took him till then. But we did see him start to come after Nate, at least much more than we saw him come after previous opponents, right? And so, I mean, you know, people critical of Sam there should give him credit there, because I believe, you know, although you could still argue that he didn't do it enough despite getting the win, he did show those improvements. So good on Sam. I'm glad he got the win. The prop didn't cash, but I don't care. I'm just going to bet Sam anyways every time because I like Sam, even if I didn't know him. Yeah, he's a smiling face. That said, I hope Nate's okay, man. I mean, I was kind of hoping Nate took the advice of his, you know, teammates and former teammates. Because there's been like this weird, like, rest in peace, and I mean this in all respect, weird, like, Evan Tanner vibe with, like, Nate Marquardt when he comes out. Like, really reminds me, like, when Evan Tanner came out with a big beard versus Kendall Grove, the Rolling Stones song, and he had that, like, thousand-mile stare like he was in Vietnam, right? Like, I just hope Nate's all right. Yeah, I guess not too much more to say about that. Did pretty good. We closed out on the prelims at, I believe, like, 6-1 or something like that. And it was good, but we're going to take a little quick break here. We'll maybe change up the music even, kind of like we did before, and we will come back and we will break down the main card, close out, and get to your submissions in transition right here on the Protect Your Neck Podcast. UFC Denver main card recap, Protect Your Neck Podcast After Party Edition. Great thing about these Fox cards is there is only 4 fights, so let's jump into it with Jason Knight versus Alex Caceres. This was a kind of dark horse contender for fight of the night for me. Obviously, most people were picking Masvidal and Cerrone, and justifiably so, but this one, you know, had action written all over it, and so it did in the beginning. Actually, in fact, Caceres was winning, like many southpaws who are more accustomed to abusing those angles. He was hitting really nice lead foot pivots and countering Knight well, you know, which is kind of a note there for any, you know, Knight's future competitors who fancy themselves a counter. But nonetheless, Knight's perseverance, yeah, well, let's be honest, perseverance and, you know, Hick Diaz attitude really came through because it was strong. You know, he was able to get him to the ground and remind people of his ground game, taking the back, and not just taking the back, it was how he was doing it, using, excellent levers like Pantoja was doing, which I didn't highlight on, Pantoja doing a beautiful job at doing those small check boxes. You know, there's a basic checklist and there's an advanced checklist. Pantoja, and even Knight to a certain extent, was checking those off. What I really liked about Knight was kind of the way he was using his back control, where there were brief moments where he had body triangle, but he didn't go to it too much, even though he arguably could have at certain points, because he was kind of keeping, there's a lot of different names for this, but just kind of an inside lace, as I like to call it, where you'll kind of cross up at almost a slight, you'll cross your legs up at almost a slight 45 degree angle, where the legs are crossed almost just above one leg. But more importantly, you were interweaving one leg, more importantly, the outside leg, because the outside leg is going to feed in to the inside of your opponent's legs if you have their back. And as that leg feeds into your opponent's legs, you kind of wrap and grapevine, if you will, instep to the back of their calf, if you will, your leg in there. And what that does is it makes it difficult. It's kind of like a hidden disruption lever when your opponent wants to turn into you. And Knight was playing those safeties well and adjusting himself accordingly. So little things, if you know what to look for, with those little check boxes, yeah, Knight was doing those pretty well. So props off to him. And, you know, obviously Caceres, you know, I was literally almost about to send out a tweet going, wow, I guess Caceres is training with BJ Penn on that bat. Those back control drills have been paying off, because he's fought out about three deep attempts that were really good. And sure enough, I didn't hit send, but I'll definitely own up to it here. Yeah. Yeah, Knight was able to sink it in, but I guess I'm not really owning up to anything because I picked Knight, right? So I guess I'm right. But I wasn't confident in that pick. As I said, this was an avoid one to many people that were asking me about this, just because on paper, it was one of the more competitive fights on paper, right? And even though Knight came out strong and kind of ended up taking over, you know, or I should say despite Caceres coming out strong, It could have very well easily played that way. So I still stand by that, and I still don't regret playing this one. Although, looking back at an 11-1 score, I kind of wish I played more tonight, but that's another story. But yeah, good win for Jason Knight. Hope to see more from Hick Diaz, and I mean that in all respect. Got love for the South. All right, next one is going to be Ngannou versus Orlovsky. I had Ngannou, like, the majority of planet Earth, but I was one of the few that was saying, like, 4-1 odds, like, hey, let's calm down. It's 4-1 odds on a heavyweight, and we haven't seen a lot of, you know, Ngannou. There's not been a huge, you know, I'm sure as you get to know me, you'll hate this word, sample size from him. And yeah, I always heed caution there, but from what I'm seeing in the trends and Orlovsky's, as much good stats as the guy has, as much as, you know, he was admittedly one of my favorites coming into the MMA game back in, you know, 2006, 2005. He's got a bad trend about him, and you can't ignore those facts. And Ngannou pulled through, but it's just so damn impressive. Like, Brian Stan tries to really say it through his commentary, which I appreciate, and you have other intelligent people who, like Patrick Wyman, who I'm a big fan of, really try to, you know, really try to explain this, you know, as intelligently and eloquently and straightforwardly as they can, whether it's through Twitter or the broadcast itself. But you have to keep in mind, 3.5 years is insane. I only have a handful of amateur kickboxing and boxing matches, and, you know, one amateur MMA fight. And granted, I have, you know, countless, you know, regional and national taekwondo, you know, and karate experience and grappling experience and this and that. It's nothing compared to a lot of these pros, okay? And it's coming from somebody who's been doing it, in other words, for 20 years in multiple martial arts, to see somebody in 3.5 years, again, I'm not stating my stats to pat me on the back. It shows just how fucking meaningless it is in the big picture when you have a man like Francis Ngannou, who in 3.5 years... can just, not like as I was saying with Eric Shelton, look the part, right? He can hold his hands in the right position and maybe throw some techniques with some good mechanics and some natural crispness that comes much faster and even more fluider than lifelong practitioners. No, Ngannou shows even the triggers and understandings of intricate parries. Like, he was showing monkey paw parries, and a monkey paw parry, there might be different names for this in Muay Thai, but coming from, you know, Chinese Kenpo and Kenpo Karate, we would call them monkey paw parries, where you use them for kicks. And it's essentially, if your hands are kind of up in your general hands up guard, you're, you know, one of your hands, doesn't matter which, it all depends on what, you know, what leg they're kicking on. It's usually the opposite leg your opponent's kicking. So if your opponent is kicking from their left, it's coming from your right side. So if it's coming from your right side, usually your left hand is going to reach down and you're going to try to kind of cup the back Achilles or heel of your opponent's kick and kind of parlay that momentum of the kick as you lean back out of range and kind of parlay that momentum to extend that momentum in the direction that it's going. So in other words, the opponent kind of inherently gets their back. You can take their back, take them down, strike, or what have you. And that's kind of the monkey paw. You're kind of gripping as you're parrying and pulling across. And although Orlovsky doesn't kick, so not just 3 years of not 3.5 years of not striking much, Orlovsky doesn't even kick that much. But the fact that when Orlovsky feinted a kick, I think he might have thrown one kick prior again. All my analysis tonight is off of one watch, so I apologize. He showed that inherent trigger of going to that parry. Now, although that kick never came, so the parry was pointless. And if you go back and rewatch the fight, he did it in midair. If you understand anything about striking or have tried to take a class and grasp a striking concept and then apply it in real time, you will understand how freaking hard that is to do at the level Ngannou is doing it, much less at against, you know, much less at 3.5 years experience. It is absurd. Okay? Sorry for that in-depth detail, but I hope that one example that I just sold out on is enough to explain it, because I really don't know how else really, because yeah, I'm just excited to see what else comes from Ngannou. Was not happy to see, you know, yet another fighter kind of meet his demise. Legend, you know, kind of put it against a young gun, which is kind of depressing, like we saw against BJ Penn and Yair Rodriguez. And another theme from BJ Penn and Yair Rodriguez we will revisit in this next fight, which is Jorge Masvidal versus Donald Cerrone. Another Jackson Wink fighter, Donald Cerrone, who was justifiably favorited against Jorge Masvidal. I initially came into this fight leaning toward Donald Cerrone. And, excuse me. Yeah, well, this was just like I was talking about. These only come up when I'm doing the podcast, right? Hiccups. But yeah, I initially leaned to Cerrone because, like I was talking with Angelo, who I believe this is one of the few picks that Angelo only got wrong. Because Angelo was pretty, I believe he was pretty spot on with his picks for the most part, too. But I thought like Angelo did. So I'm not criticizing Angelo or anybody else that picked Cerrone. It was Cerrone's the justified favorite. I thought Masvidal's, even though he did pull and return to success, which we'll talk about in a second, I thought his kind of quote-unquote slick boxing and his kind of dependency on head and trunk movement to fuel that pull and return style would cost him against a guy who's corralling that range with some of the best, most varied head kick setup, and head kick finishes in the game, which is Donald Cerrone. So I did not blame anybody for picking that, but I ultimately ended up siding with the bad guy, Tony Montana, Scarface, Jorge Masvidal, because I felt that this was going to look like Nate Diaz versus Donald Cerrone, which it did, minus the fact that there was a finish. Masvidal stayed true to that center line, and he was actually surprisingly willing to play Cerrone's tie game more than I expect. I mean, he wasn't doing those typical, it was good that he was doing leg checks and he was showing that he was checking the legs. Maybe that was the purpose of it, but I was a little worried at first, although the momentum seemed to sway. Masvidal hit him with a few jabs and crosses at that point, but Masvidal was doing the typical, there's probably a better word for it that's just not coming to it now, but your typical tie marches where you'll kind of do, you almost kind of step, stomp, and feint. And you'll parlay your checks like you're showing a check and lifting your leg, but you'll kind of parlay it into a step down and kick. But if your opponent's good, like Cerrone, you'll often wait for your opponent to show your checks. And when they show a false check, when you don't kick, you'll usually punish your opponent when they step down. Because not only are you catching them obviously stepping down, you're using that as an advantageous timing to land your shot. But the step down is going to lend into your shot as far as it's going to hurt them more. And if you ever spar with a good Muay Thai person, which I have, Shout out to Mike Moss and the Muay Thai sparring days, and shout out to pro fighter Justin James, who arguably has some of the hardest leg kicks in the Extreme Couture pro room. Anybody who knows what I'm talking about knows what I'm talking about. Yeah, you take leg kicks from good guys, it's gonna sting. But I think Cerrone seemed too compromised to capitalize on what I would argue he would usually capitalize on. Masvidal was just getting his game going, and he wasn't even doing the verbal or obvious trash talk of a Nate Diaz or even of a Matt Brown. But he made it clear, like he said at the stare down at the weigh-in, it was not a sparring session. He was able to abuse that center line, like I suspected, and although I thought the body shots would come into play, and although I did, you know, I did put a little flyer on the decision because I thought maybe it might go to the decision. And this new Masvidal was going to win the decision because everybody has the old Masvidal in their head, which I don't blame them. The old Masvidal is not that long ago, right? Lulls in inactivity. But yeah, no shame there. I still stand by it. Masvidal gets the win. So it's kind of sad that he has to bet $200K to get the promotional push. But hopefully, you know, if anybody has the ear to the WMIE, whatever you want to call it, mystery, the people running the organization now, I hope Masvidal does. I hope that rumor is true and hope he can get some pull here that he's asking for with Dana and the organization to get some long-awaited big matches, because this was his biggest match, and I'm glad he came through with shining colors. So props to Masvidal. We missed the prop, but we hit the pick for the reasons stated. You know, I don't think Cerrone performs too well at home, and his tendencies were in full effect. As you listen to the commentary, you would have heard his concert and outgoing endeavors. But not hating on that, just it is what it is, right? Oh, sorry. Goes don't hate me. Goes from Junkie hates that saying. It is what it is. Shout out to MMA Junkie Radio. The real homies over there, those guys are awesome. But all right, we're going to get to the main event. Shevchenko versus Pena. As you guys know, I'm a huge Shevchenko homer. I love me some Shevchenko, but I actually came into this fight initially favoring Pena on paper because, you know, it's no secret. Shevchenko's weakest point is what? Her ground. Urgency, technics, right? And Pena's strength is what? Being on top. That's kind of her one goal. But the more I looked at it, the more I looked at the analysis, I swayed towards Shevchenko because it almost looked like a Rousey home scenario setup, which is probably why my man, shout out to Robin Black, who gets my vote for Analyst of the Year at least. I love Robin Black. I love his work. And also did, by the way, great prediction. Nailed Masvidal. And although he wasn't exactly correct with the round one that Angelo Reyes was saying he predicted, I was with Robin in the sense that I could get why he was saying the round one, because yeah, this seemed like that Rousey home setup where you have one fighter who's so dependent on the clinch and who's so foreign with defeat, even though she has defeats on her record where Rousey didn't at the time, so foreign with defeat mentally and so dependent on that winning mindset, and as impressive as that mindset is and as strong as her determination is, those often take the biggest falls. And that's what I saw happening here. I actually was calling it through body shots. So if we're getting down to the nitty gritty of, you know, the way as opposed to the pick, I was wrong, you know, not with the pick, of course, but with the way, because I was calling body shots more toward the third round, like Angela Reyes was calling body shots toward the third round. But it was actually Pena landing body shots early. And although Shevchenko seemed, you know, she showed that lackadaisicalness that she tended to show on bottom that she addressed. We'll get to that in a second. She showed that lackadaisicalness in the clinch. She was taking a lot of knees that I didn't think she needed to be taking there. That said, she parlayed nicely, didn't she? She showed that Muay Thai. Again, I'm telling you, apparently nobody like goes back and watches. Well, I don't blame him. I'm a freaking nerd that has nothing better to do. I went back and watched all of Shevchenko's Muay Thai footage. I mean, this is for her past couple fights I've done this. And she makes all her money inside the clinch. I mean, when most of her opponents were trying to achieve plums, she was almost going under their armpits, going around underneath toward their back, almost to a right angle in a Greco-Roman style clinch body lock and sweeping their feet with outside trips, Because she's better with outside trips and inside trips, mind you, which is how Julia Pena has scored practically all, at least 7 out of her 8 takedowns in the UFC by. Shevchenko's better and has a better base and balance, which she showed despite getting takedown once or, I believe, twice. In Muay Thai, she would almost go under her opponent's arms, like I was saying, in the most Greco-like clinch, and then kind of sweep them out from underneath. And before she would do that, she would knee them, not to just to the thighs, but to the glutes, to the ass, in other words, like in a really mean fashion. And then when she would just take them down to further prove her point, she would land and mount whenever she could in Muay Thai. And obviously, you can't ground fight in Muay Thai. You'll know that the referee stands them back up after they allow, because they do allow clinch wrestling in Muay Thai, but they don't allow like grappling on the floor, obviously. They would stand him back up, but the fact that Shevchenko would sneak in these knees in the butt, the fact that she would mount these people, kind of showed her mean competitive streak. And she seems like a sweetheart as a person. I know people that know her personally, the aforementioned Junkie Radio guys who were on that Countdown show, who spent time with her. They did the Countdown show with her as far as going to the shooting range in the military. I mean, she's legitimately a nice person, but. When you compete from age 5, like I was saying on Twitter, it's like wrestlers, who have been competing since childhood. Lifelong martial artist is often an abused term, but she really is it. And she carries that competitive advantage, that competitive intangible, if you will, that wrestlers and lifelong competitors carry. She is no joke. She was born in the Taekwondo base and did real Muay Thai work. It's kind of debatable, and world champions, kind of Chael Sonnen was saying with Holly Holm's titles and whatnot, but as far as that world goes and what you have to kind of work with to achieve those titles, it's a give and take thing, but it doesn't get much more legit than Shevchenko, K1, IMFA, defeating Njaychek 3 times. Don't let those promos fool you saying, as great as Holly Holm and Duranda may are, that they are the most accoladed strikers. Like, you could make the argument that Shevchenko is the most accoladed striker, not just at 135, but in all UFC divisions, which makes her the most accoladed on-paper striker of any female striker in any female MMA division, right? Right? I mean, you look at, the victory she holds over Joanna Jędrzejczyk, who rules the bottom division. This division hasn't been creative, but you have one girl with mixed success and lack of a well-rounded game facing another who has a big name in Holly Holm, but coming off 2 losses and just lost to Shevchenko. And, like I said, it's kind of arguable titles in her own right. I mean, not trying to take away from those girls. I'm a fan of Duranda. I'm a fan of Holm. I'm a fan of even Jacek, obviously. But you can make that argument. Shevchenko is the best female striker in the MMA divisions. But that doesn't matter, does it, Dan? Because she finished this fight by submission. That's right. She does hold submission victories. Let's not forget that. I believe it's like 5-2 submission or 2 TKOs. 5 submissions and 2 TKOs, I believe, over her whole UFC career, which will be updated now. So I guess it's not a surprise, but me or myself, we're not looking at people. Oh, I'm sorry, 4 KOs and 6 submissions. Yeah, my mistake there. But let's see. So one. Yeah, only one official by armbar of those. But maybe you credit a little bit of Rosie Namajunas' work there, huh? Working with the armbar there. But no, Shevchenko's always had an underrated ground game, but not so much from bottom. I was one waving the Shevchenko flag in many ways, including her ground game, but not even I was saying anything from the bottom. This was something I was hopefully expecting, if you want to say, that she would show improvements on, as she did. People were complaining right before the finish, I saw tweets, and rightfully so. Her urgency wasn't exactly where you'd like to see it, but the techniques were improved. And I said she needed to improve urgency, and she needed to improve techniques. Well, the urgency wasn't as improved, but the techniques not only were improved, but they were enough to get the job done. She was setting up that high guard setup for quite a couple times. I mean, she would even go for a same side mirrored wrist control, not a cross wrist, but same side wrist control where you grab the wrist of your opponent from the same side, and you kind of feed it across theirs and yours body, and that's going to kind of create the angle and open that kind of slight 45 angle lane for your hips to come up and for you to start working for that armbar. She did that about 2-3 times to my count, and again, I got to go back and look at this, but this was kind of just offhand. I guess that's the one downfall of the after party edition. A little hard to pull this stuff right after the fact, no matter where the broadcast is through. But yeah, she was setting it up once Pena did finally get the takedown and got her to the clinch. So although Pena was successful with her objective, as we expected, to not let this become a striking realm, Pena got the jump on, or Shevchenko got the jump on her as Pena looked just in disbelief. Now, again, with that confidence, she was going to take this harder than anybody, Pena, that is. But you really saw the disbelief in her eyes there at the end. And all props to Shevchenko, though. How can you not be happy for her? I said I couldn't call her my dark horse anymore, and I definitely can't now. But this is one of those few fighters where you can kind of, you know, I hate the red team versus blue team. I told you so. Like, I try to actively be the last guy to do that. But there are certain fighters that I do admit certain bias for, whether it's a bias where I have to put an asterisk because they're an extreme couture person, or it's a bias like Shevchenko just because I really like and relate and identify and appreciate and all of the above of their style. Perhaps I don't have to state a bias there, as we should be doing that, and many of us do that, but I do. I try to be as honest and straightforward with my opinions and through my spot as an analyst and breaking down these fights as I can. But yeah, Shevchenko's up there with the Robert Whittakers and the Smolkas, despite his not having, you know, the mixed success lately, and other guys as well, who is not coming to my name at the moment. But yeah, good on Shevchenko. I wasn't disappointed to see that stare down, you know. I second my man out there, James Lynch. Shout out to James Lynch, Flow Combat and Odds Breaker, and just one of the best YouTube channels. Subscribe to James Lynch and stuff. But he was saying he really appreciates that. And, you know, pro wrestling or not, I appreciate it too, especially with girls like this who need to build. I mean, whether you like Nunes, Shevchenko, or both, as you should, they need to get out there more, and they deserve it. They deserve it arguably much more than the girls who are beginning the push. I can tell you that much. Actually, I definitely can tell you that much. They definitely deserve the push more. So get behind these girls in any way that you can that's reasonable and not creepy. And yeah, support them. It's going to be a good fight. Hopefully they can build it up. Hopefully they will do them a service. I have a feeling that's kind of one of those fights they may attach to a Conor or a bigger name kind of thing. Although, I don't even want to say that with the stuff that went on tonight. That's another story with the whole Conor and tweets. I'll let the regular MMA journals cover that stuff. I'll keep mine to analysis and, you know, things that don't get covered that much, because that's what I do and that's what I do proudly. So whatever I do go forward, whatever adjustments I make to the format going forward, I'm going to be sure to keep doing that. We close at 11-1 for picks. It was a good night. Somewhat profitable night, too, for UFC Denver with the plays. Hopefully you did well. I avoided a lot. I want to say I hope you did, too, but I kind of wish I played more, and hopefully you did well, because I would have done well if I played more with the 11-1, but I hit a pretty nice profit percentage that I still have to calculate off the very limited funds that were left in my account after the last one. All right. Okay. Well, we're going to go to submissions in transition. This is where, if it's a top five episode, you submit your top five. Or if it's a breakdown episode, you want something broken down, a question on a prop, play, technical question, whatever, you use hashtag ProtectYourNeckPodcast. And for the after party edition, of course, you can just still technical questions and hot takes to be asked, but yeah, hot takes, technical takes, whatever you have, you give it through that way. So I'm gonna go and check the Twitter crystal ball, if you will, as I pull up some notifications here. All right, dead air is awesome, isn't it? All right, here's the first one. Is from my man, Keith McKenna, at Keith McKenna. Yeah, yes, if you submit, you will get shouted out with your handle and all that good stuff. If that's something you're into, there's another incentive. Keith said, people slept on Shevchenko grappling and clinch work. Ngannou is a heavy, serious threat. All right. Yeah. Kind of spoken on it a bit with Shevchenko and how kind of people often overlook. You know, we've seen so many strikers fail in MMA. It's so easy to have that trigger in your mind where you're like, oh, grappler's gonna win this fight. And we've even seen odds makers, including the kind of general lexicon, adjust where, you know, wrestlers aren't always a shoo-in to beat, you know, the striker, right? It's evolved. The information's out there. And guys are learning. So not only that, if there's any striking style that's going to really translate, I don't want to say to MMA because then that you're really even getting into more subjective territory that I'm already swimming in. But if any striking style is going to translate to grappling, you can count that that is traditional Muay Thai. Traditional Muay Thai, although like with Shevchenko, can create slow starts because you are using that to get the rhythm, and there's almost kind of a built-in culture there from the music, and it's kind of already getting a pace set before the fight. There's just so much built-in things there that are kind of hard to get into if you haven't really seen or experienced it. But another thing about that is they do a lot of clinch wrestling. I mean, even in the preparation, if you've taken even a Muay Thai class from anybody who has somewhat of a traditional Muay Thai base, there are going to be some of those classes where they're going to have you neck wrestle. And those are like the most tiring classes because you're not even, for the most part, unless you're in, you know, some camps that, you know, have a disregard for body shots, which there are some, you know, you're not going to be blasting your sparring partners or your classmate partners' knees to the body. So you're kind of really working on leverage points from the Thai plum, re-wrestling in, swimming in to get the Thai plum, kind of doing step backs and kind of getting momentum to have them step forward to what would be powerful knees you'd be greeting them with, so on and etc. And so just by nature, you kind of develop a sense of your core, a sense of balance. And that's going to translate real nicely into clinch wrestling. So even if they're not going to be as offensive as you see them in their Muay Thai games, they're at least a little better defensively than most strikers. Sometimes a lot better defensively, I should say, than most strikers when it comes to their transition to MMA and their defending of takedowns. So very overlooked. You're right, Keith, with that. And yeah, Ngannou is just, wow. I was really trying to temper what everybody else was saying, but it was a big test with Arlovski, and you can still argue, you know, with Arlovski being dropped or stopped in his last five fights, now six fights. It was still a big test for Ngannou. We still really didn't see much. And that said, you know, play devil's advocate. We really still didn't see much in this fight, right? Calling out Cain Velasquez is bold, and so is, you know, the arguable best strikers, Alistair Overeem and Junior Dos Santos, the former and future challenger and former champion as well of the division, heavyweight divisions, right? With those two guys. I mean, wow. I would still favor all those three mentioned over Ngannou at this point because we haven't seen Ngannou. I picked Blades, who is kind of like a raw green Cain Velasquez, possibly. We'll see where he goes, but you look at the NCAA and you look at his offensive wrestling style when you look at his NCAA footage, and then you kind of look at how he's kind of transitioned into MMA. You know, there's a lot of upsides for Blades, which is another conversation, but that threat was still there. You know, Ngannou wasn't looking gassed or super tired, but could have been, you know? Could have been an interesting third round at the very least, all right? So keep that in mind. Another one, kind of an add to the point from Keith. Not a UFC Denver point, but he loved the Diego Brown's helicopter armbar. Yeah, helicopter armbar. That's like, fucking, I think I literally, like, speaking of day one shit, I think I learned that. I mean, that's not something you should learn day one, but I think I learned that in my day one in, like, my first official non-garage random fighter-related jiu-jitsu class over a decade ago. And, yeah, I don't know if I've seen that successful, at least in high-level MMA or UFC, for sure, the helicopter armbar. But Diego Brandão, he looked in pretty decent shape though, didn't he? I didn't see the whole what was it, EFN, I believe. Yeah, I didn't see that whole broadcast. I was kind of in and out pre-fight today because I knew the card started early as far as UFC Denver. But that was definitely a fun one. Good mention, Keith. This isn't exactly an official entry, but I got Angelo. here, or at least not here in person, but on message. And Angelo saying, yeah, he's agreeing with me. He said, I did pretty good on his picks, and he did. But he did pick Cowboy, but he came away with the same notes I did. Angelo said, yep, Masvidal definitely kept his left hand up much more, and Cerrone didn't. And that was the truth, right? Because Cerrone, at first, he's had success. He hit Masvidal with that big left hook, like I said, with the Brandon Gibson edition. Not only is Cerrone doing good with his left hook, but he's using his left hook to punch out of the exchanges. So it's really been serving him well. And it tagged Masvidal hard early. It tagged him a couple times, but it tagged him really hard and clean early. But it wasn't enough, because Masvidal was able to counter and come over the top cleanly, albeit cleanly, you know, sometimes than others, but he was able to come over the top with his right hands that Cerrone has traditionally been hittable to, you know, throughout his career, even with the Brandon Gibson iteration, which, shout out to Brandon Gibson, because both me and Angelo are both, you know, big fans of Brandon Gibson and what he's done, and his force over there, his presence, I should say, at Jackson Wink. So definite shout outs there. All right, that looks about it. Again, if you do want your stuff contributed to, or said, I will. I mean, as long as it's not, you know, hate speech or propaganda. Political propaganda. I will shout you out and give you appropriate credit here on the Protect Your Neck podcast. Just use the hashtag Protect Your Neck podcast for that, and you can join in on the show. Follow Angelo Reyes, by the way, at Reyes Striking, and check out his show, Cage Siders. You just type in Cage Siders on iTunes, it'll pop up. It's a really good show he's got going on there. Big shout outs, really, just to all the support and stuff this week. It really meant a lot. Again, it was kind of a rough week content-wise, with the Submission Underground pieces kind of not following through. But I'm still really proud of those pieces, so if you got a read of it, you were probably able to learn stuff that you didn't know about Hector Lombard, Cuban Judo, catch wrestling, Jeff Munson, and Chad Mendez. So hopefully you were able to get your eyes on those somehow, some way. Keep an eye out to flowcombat.com for my future work and breakdowns. And, of course, mixedmartialanalyst.com is where you'll have the entirety of my work and any breakdowns that aren't being covered by Flow. Either way, both will have you covered. So stay tuned to both. And in the meantime, in the parlance, I should say, of our favorite, Dwayne Ludwig, protect your neck, motherfuckers.